The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Lawfare Archive.
I'm Jacob Schultz with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for September 11th, 2021. Today, it's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. From the archives, I picked a conversation from 2012 between Alan Rosenstein, now a senior editor at Lawfare, and University of Toronto professor Kent Roach about Roach's then new book, The 9/11 Effect: Comparative Counterterrorism. It's a conversation that's relevant to the past 20 years of American history and particularly interesting to reflect on today.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Today's subject is a new book by University of Toronto law professor Kent Roach entitled The 9/11 Effect: Comparative Counterterrorism. The book, recently published by Cambridge University Press, takes a look at the response of the United Nations and a bunch of countries to the 9/11 attacks, examining the common themes in the responses of democratic countries. Roach, who is the editor-in-chief of Criminal Law Quarterly, talked with Lawfare's Alan Rosenstein the other day by phone.
So, Professor Roach, thank you so much for joining us today. Your book, The 9/11 Effect, is a very rigorous and in-depth comparative study of counterterrorism law and policy post 9/11. And the first thing I'd like to ask is if you could just give a summary of your project in this book and your general approach and what you think the main conclusions or the main takeaways are from the book.
Well, the book represents more or less a decade of research and service in a lot of these areas. And so I think that, you know, the main approach has been as an academic to say, how can we measure the effect that 9/11 made on a global basis? Now, the book doesn't attempt to look at, obviously, every jurisdiction, but I think it does look at about 12 or 13, and it looks quite closely at the United Nations. So in terms of the main conclusions of the book, I think I do find trends towards increased state power in an attempt to prevent another 9/11, but that in each of these countries there's a lot of continuity with respect to security practices before 9/11. I also find that the UN Security Council has been a real driver of counterterrorism policy, and I raise some questions there. I like to think that, you know, although there are plenty of criticisms of the Security Council and states for violating human rights, that I also take on board concerns about the efficacy of counterterrorism policies. And then I guess finally, the last main theme in the book and reflects probably my own experience working on Canada's Arar Commission and the Air India Commission is that as we move to whole government and indeed transnational approaches with respect to counterterrorism, that there's some pretty fundamental accountability gaps, again, both with respect to human rights compliance, but also with respect to the efficacy of counterterrorism activities. So although, you know, walls have been broken down and governments are attempting to take more of a whole-of-government approach, many of our review mechanisms remain mired in agency-based silos. And even when there are whole-of-government attempts to ensure, let's say, the efficacy of counterterrorism policies, they often are not effective. So the accountability gap theme is one that I think is very important, and it plays out both on the human rights and the security side of the ledger.
You criticize what I think you characterize as the inadequacy of the UN's definition of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And you repeatedly emphasize that the UN really missed an important opportunity to create a broad but sort of appropriately limited definition of terrorism. And so the two questions I have for you are, one, what would this definition look like for you? And second, why do you think the UN had such trouble, if indeed it did, in coming to this ideal definition?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the UN made a decision after 9/11 really not to take on the definitional issues. So, you know, Security Council Resolution 1373 really says nothing about definitions, and the Security Council only comes in 2004 after many countries have already enacted new laws. And I think that, you know, in a sense is understandable because, you know, there had been a lack of international agreement with respect to definitions. But I do think that there was an opportunity there for perhaps a year after 9/11 to say, you know, regardless of fights about state terrorism or freedom fighting, what happened on 9/11 was an act of terrorism. And so the definition that I prefer is actually the one the Supreme Court of Canada used immediately after 9/11 in dealing with an undefined reference to terrorism in our immigration law, and that is taken from the general definition in the 1999 Financing Convention, and it's basically intentional killing or bodily harm in order to intimidate a population or compel governments or international organizations to act. And although that may lean on the side of under inclusion, you know, especially with respect to cyber threats and the like, I think it would have provided a more solid foundation for this kind of global expansion of counterterrorism laws that we saw immediately after 9/11 as countries wanted to comply with 1373, but also many countries were dealing with these issues because of the Financial Action Task Force's adding of terrorism financing to its money laundering mandate.
So the question then is what you think sort of the real negative consequences are. Is it an issue that some countries, because they didn't have a restraining definition of terrorism, expanded that definition to include, for instance, political dissidents and others who sort of ought not be classified as terrorists, even if they're politically minded, or is it that it got in the way of cooperation between nations in global counterterrorism?
I think that it is more of the former, and so, you know, particularly when you read the early country reports from, say, Egypt and Syria, which are two countries that I look at in the book, you see that the Counterterrorism Committee really seems unable to push back against potential misuses of the term terrorism, because to a certain extent they haven't been given the tools with respect by the Security Council with respect to definition. This starts to change, and you know, my criticisms and the criticisms that others have made of the Security Council's counterterrorism committee as a kind of rights-free zone, I think, start to diminish around 2004 and 2005, and the Security Council does start taking human rights on a bit more. But by that time, I think a lot of the damage with respect to passage of new laws and legitimization of old repressive laws has been done. And so, I mean, on this issue, you know, I disagree with those who say it's kind of impossible to define what terrorism is. And I also think that there was a point in history with the evolving laws of war and armed conflict that we could agree on a relatively narrow definition of terrorism and place a lot of the other issues that had bedeviled agreement on a definition of terrorism, push those over to the evolving laws of war. But as I said, I think that opportunity was unfortunately lost.
So I'd like to move now to considering some of the country studies that you do in your book. So you go through, in addition to the United States, you very closely examine the United Kingdom, Australia, and Canada, and you also more briefly talk about countries that already had fairly robust laws in place before 9/11 or chose not to change those laws substantially, countries like Israel, Singapore, and Indonesia. The first question is, most of the countries that you talk about are their common law regimes. Many of them are Commonwealth countries. Is that why did you make that choice? Is that an issue of expertise, or was there a particular rationale for looming it to those countries and not considering in depth, for instance, France, Germany, China, places like that?
Yes. No. I mean, it was an issue of expertise. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about the nature of comparative law, and I see very much the book as trying to define counterterrorism law, which in itself is an extremely broad category, as an important new field of comparative law. And so there's a debate within comparative law between people who do small n and people who do large n studies, n being the number of studies, a number of countries that are examined. And I guess I, perhaps chose a typical Canadian sort of compromise where I wanted a number of countries, but I wanted countries that I was relatively familiar with. So with some exceptions, I've taught and lectured in almost all of the countries that I dealt with. So I felt it was important to have a sense of, even if it was only a brief sense, of the political and legal culture of each country, especially with respect to examining the hypothesis about continuity post and pre 9/11. The oddest country, in a way, that's included in the book is Indonesia, but frankly, that just reflects the fact that I was brought in as a consultant after 9/11 and before Bali, to give advice to the Indonesians about whether they needed a new counterterrorism law. But it seems to me that if you really want to engage with the political and legal culture, as well as to have a sense of the broad array of instruments that any one country now uses as counterterrorism law, ranging not only from criminal law, which is my primary subject, but to administrative law and immigration law, military law, and so on, that there is a danger of oversimplification if you dealt with too many countries. So I think there are others that are working on countries, especially with respect to continental Europe. I think that that's probably the largest gap in my study. But I see this really as a kind of continuing conversation, and I really hope that counterterrorism law becomes a subject of comparative law, as we move forward.
So you discuss one of the hypotheses that you make in the book that runs throughout this issue of continuity, and I want to turn to England and discuss that first. So one of the striking features of, as you emphasize, of the English response is, first, how much it draws on England's own long and difficult history with domestic terrorism, specifically related to Northern Ireland, and how even before 9/11, England's approach was building off of that and was highly legal, which is to say it was based on an enormous amount of legislation rather than, as you point out, in countries like the United States, where there was a lot more coming from executive policy. So the first question I'd like to ask is, in what ways you think the Northern Irish experience and in more generally England's experience with homegrown terrorism shaped its response to 9/11?
Yeah. Well, I mean certainly the Terrorism Act 2000, which was already in existence before 9/11, was really a consolidation of a variety of temporary laws that had been enacted in response to Irish terrorism, both in Northern Ireland and in England. But I would actually go farther back, because one of the reasons why England is such an important country in the study actually relates to my discussions of places like Israel and Singapore, and that is that the British colonial experience with colonial emergencies really played a very large role. So in the book, I try to trace, as others have, British colonial emergency regimes to things like the Internal Security Act in Singapore and in Malaysia, and some of the mandate regimes that are still in place in Israel. And so I think that the British experience of kind of ruling by legislation that could be imported to the colonies with certain changes was extremely important after 9/11. And so, for example, when I was in Indonesia, there was some suspicion, especially among some younger Indonesians, that, a person for who all intents and purposes looks and sounds like an American was trying to bring the Patriot Act to Indonesia. And my response to that was, even if I wanted to, you basically couldn't do it because of the particular complexities of the American legal system. What the real debate was about was, to what degree was the Terrorism Act 2000 from England going to be the basis for legislation, or were you going to take some other variations on that? So, I mean, it seems to me that the UK experience, both with Northern Ireland, but also with colonial emergency rule, was really quite fundamental after 9/11. And of course, the fact that the Terrorism Act 2000 was the most recent comprehensive piece of terrorism legislation meant that many countries especially in the Commonwealth, but also beyond the Commonwealth, even countries like Indonesia, looked to the British legislation as at least a starting point when they drafted their own responses to 9/11 and Security Council Resolution 1373.
Going back to English colonial history and the way that England controlled its empire was, to the extent that during English, during the imperial period, an enormous amount of control was given to the local English officials who were then sent to run these various places. Why is it that England then, in dealing with counterterrorism later, chose a legislative rather than more executive-based approach? Because I can imagine it would be just as natural for them to say, well, the way that we controlled these populations was by dispatching these very powerful governors and other types of you know, what we would think of as quintessentially executive-type officials. And so I'm wondering, was there a change there, and if so, why?
Well, I mean, obviously the decline of empire and the growth of self-government and self-determination means that, you know, whether you're talking about England or the United States, that kind of direct response is not going to be on. You know, certainly issues of cooperation and funding play a role, but I would suggest that even during the times of British colonial emergency rule, although individual governors obviously played a role, those governors also brought with them a legislative apparatus. And there's a certain candor, I think, in the British legislative approach that we don't necessarily see in the North American approach. And so, you know, that's why, you know, I think one of the you know, basic insights of the book that some in the United States, I think, find shocking is if you read the Terrorism Act 2000 from England and you read it next to the Patriot Act, the Terrorism Act 2000 is a much more, you know, tougher document and deals with things like prescriptions of organizations, criminal penalties for belonging to organizations, criminal penalties for expressing support for proscribed organizations that would just never come up in American or indeed Canadian legislation. And so I think that even the British colonial experience was one that was in part ruled by legislation often drafted in London and perhaps modified to fit the particular colonies. But this is why if you read the Internal Security Act in Singapore and Malaysia, if you read some of the emergency ordinance in Israel, there's a real kind of common phrasing. And as a Commonwealth lawyer, you can kind of land almost anywhere in the Commonwealth, whether it's Kenya, which also had emergency legislation, Israel during the mandate period, Malaysia, and fairly quickly find your ground because they all are kind of working on a very similar template.
And so I think that, and this was also one of the points that I thought was most interesting in the book, was the point you just made that a lot of the English legislation, which then was exported to the rest of the world and has been, as you point out, much, much more influential than, for instance, the Patriot Act or, frankly, any kind of American counterterrorism policy, is in many ways much harsher than American legislation. And I just want to be clear on why I think that is. So one of the points that you discuss is, and I think you just emphasized, was England's experience with both domestic terrorism and also, you know, occupation, which the United States also has, but I suppose to a lesser extent. And that's one factor. And I wonder, the second factor that you discuss also is the fact that America has, because of its particular constitutional order and in particular the Bill of Rights, limitations on what the American government can do that I suppose just don't exist in England. I mean, are those the two factors that you think sort of fully explain why this English legislation is in so many ways much harsher than the American legislation?
Yes, and it is. I mean, I think the American privileging of expressive and associational freedoms is really the most striking differences. But of course, as I suggest in the book, it doesn't mean that the American response isn't harsh, but it does mean that it is not going to involve limitations on the rights of expressive and associational freedoms, particularly of American citizens. And so, you know, this is an area of, I guess, American exceptionalism, although frankly, as a Canadian, I think we're much closer to the American tradition when it comes to some of those expressive and associational freedoms. And so although Canada certainly looked at the Terrorism Act 2000 and used it, we stopped short with respect to, you know, criminalizing membership in a proscribed group or criminalizing support for a proscribed terrorist group. So I do think it is the expressive and associational freedoms. And you know, perhaps where I saw that most.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is delete me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports, at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and DeleteMe has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide DeleteMe with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
Dramatically revealed is if you read the U.S. and Canadian country reports to the Security Council with respect to Resolution 1624, which called on states to enact laws or to ensure that the indirect advocacy of terrorism was a crime. 1624 was very much a British initiative led by Prime Minister Blair after the London bombings. And he in fact, had less trouble convincing the Security Council than he had his own parliament. But if you read the American response to that Security Council resolution, it basically says, well, we have a thing called the First Amendment in the United States, and that's really going to make it impossible for us to follow this international mandate. So it is the expressive and associational freedoms in the United States that really, I think, distinguish its approach from the approach taken in the UK, but also in continental Europe, where concepts of militant democracy provide some legitimacy for attempts to curtail expressive and associational freedoms in order to prevent terrorism.
And just to be clear, when you talk about militant democracy, you're referring to this view that it is legitimate for a democracy to take often coercive measures, such as restricting certain associational and expressive rights in order to preserve that democracy. So
exactly.
The Weimar Republic here being the classic example of when that might be useful.
Exactly.
And those lessons learned from that period.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, I think there are differences between the English version of militant democracy, which you see in the post-London bombing offenses with respect to glorification of terrorism and indirect advocacy, and the post-World War II German version of militant democracy, which allows parties to be banned if they do not accept the constitutional order. But I think the common thread there and what distinguishes them from the United States is a willingness to infringe expressive and associational freedoms, even if it is only to prevent a fairly remote harm to the constitutional order and a fairly remote harm of terrorist violence.
So I'd like to go back to the statement that you made that although the English legislative approach to counterterrorism was harsher than the American, we might argue was harsher than the American legislative approach. That's not true generally, and you have to look to where a lot of the counterterrorism policy in America came from, namely from the executive branch. So I was hoping to turn to the United States. So I think it's absolutely true that the United States had an enormous amount of counterterrorism policy coming from the executive. Some of that might have been an accident of which particular administration was in office during 9/11 and right afterwards, and what their particular views of the appropriate role of the executive branch relative to the other branches of government was in counterterrorism and foreign policy. But just as a preliminary matter, How much of the difference between the U.S. approach and, let's say, the English approach can be explained simply by the fact that the U.S. has a presidential system with a lot of separation of powers, with very frequent divided government, with these strong traditions of disagreement relative to the English approach with parliamentary supremacy and the ability to, I don't want to say jam through necessarily, but the ability to pass huge sweeping changes that often touch on the kind of constitutional order without too much trouble. So just to sort of make it clearer, to what extent did, let's say, the Bush administration's use of executive power come just from the fact that when you have to act very quickly in the United States, there's often just not enough time to get things through Congress, or as much through Congress as you might like?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly that is part of the difference. And in Canada, we've, had quite a few minority governments. And when you have a minority government in Parliament, that is a government that can't push Parliament to do exactly what it wants. You're reminded that in most cases in parliamentary systems, the government can. But I think that can actually be overstated, and I'll take two examples, one from the UK and one from the United States. Both Prime Minister Blair and Brown had real trouble getting through 42 and 90 days maximums of preventive arrests, and in fact, their backbenchers refused to go that far. So I think that is a reminder that there is, I think, a real virtue of putting these more extreme executive measures before a deliberative body for debate, and debate not only in Parliament but in civil society. In the United States, I mean, you're right that the Bush administration had a particularly broad view of executive powers, but I also think that there are some real continuities with the Obama administration. So, to the extent that the authorization of the use of military force, which is a pretty bare bones document, is still the basis. It is a congressional basis, but it is the basis for much of what the Obama administration is doing. And so I do think that there is a greater comfort level in the United States with giving the executive quite a wide latitude. And even in places like Canada, the executive is always, I think, in counterterrorism, regardless of what constitutional system you're operating with. It's always going to have a lot of latitude and is going to be, in essence, the first responder. But things like the Arar Commission show that in Canada, when the executive is seen to have participated in something that many feel is a mistake, that the government feels compelled to unleash pretty strong accountability measures, which frankly you don't always see with respect to executive conduct in the United States.
So I think one of the main claims that you make in your analysis of the United States experience, and I think one of the most bold and provocative claims, is this argument about extra legalism, which you characterize as really pervasive throughout not just the early Bush administration and the first 2 years after 9/11, but almost throughout and continuing to the present day. So first, I just want to make sure that we're clear on the terms. It's extra legalism is used in many different contexts, and it can get a bit vague. But you define it, I think, quite clearly. So you say it's, quote, illegal conduct that was nevertheless supported by dubious claims of legality, and the apparent paradox of the American response to 9/11 being dominated by lawyers, yet so often resulting in illegal actions such as rendition, torture, and warrantless spying. So
yes, I think it's important for listeners to understand that I do distinguish extra legalism from purely extra legal conduct of the type that Orrin Gross talked about in his 2003 Yale Law Journal article, because it seems to me that the difference is not that much of what was done in the United States is, in a sense, covered by claims of legality, or just as importantly, claims of non-reviewability by the courts, whether that's done through political questions or qualified immunity, refusal to extend Bivens damage claims. So, I think where my concept of extra legalism differs from purely extra legal conduct is that it makes the claim that the American legal system is really facilitating this sort of conduct, and that there are serious claims made that this conduct is either legal or cannot be reviewed by the courts.
So let me ask, what I want to push back just a little bit on is whether or not that term usefully encompasses the whole set of phenomena you're trying to explain. So on the one hand, you have, I think, some of the most extreme examples, the so-called torture memos, which expressed really incredibly broad claims of executive power that often were, you know, even if they were expressed with a good faith, that is to say, even if this is what, John, you really thought, were truly outside the mainstream. And were, in fact, used as cover to perform perform acts that are generally now considered illegal. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have things like the military commissions, you have the restrictions on habeas for Guantanamo prisoners, and these are now legal regimes that have been exhaustively vetted by all three branches of the government. So the executive branch, obviously, but Congress as well, with its repeated attempts to strip, let's say, Guantanamo detainees of habeas, and also the Supreme Court. So we see this, for example, in the aftermath of Boumediene, where the Supreme Court essentially remanded to the D.C. Circuit to craft a habeas regime, and then has refused to revisit this issue, essentially, to a lot of commentators, blessing the fairly limited rights of Guantanamo prisoners for review. And so my question is, on that side of the spectrum, when all three branches of the government have weighed in and have essentially blessed a particular policy, to what extent is it useful to call it extra legal? And just to be clear,
we might think
it's bad policy, et cetera, et cetera, but it seems deeply legal.
Yes, no, I agree with that completely, but that's the reason why I called it extra legalism. I think the ISM makes a huge difference. So, I mean, just to be clear, that, you know, I'm not saying that this is the torture ticking time bomb sort of scenario where an interrogator will say, you know, look, I'm going to do something, I'm going to break the law, and I'm prepared to pay the consequences. So I think that even though all of the branches of governments have vetted this, I mean, certainly that increases the transparency. And one of the things that I really admire about the American system, although I think many in the United States are increasingly concerned about it, is the degree of transparency that so much of this has been vetted not only by all three branches of government, but also by the New York Times revealing it. So, yes, there is a lot to be admired with respect to that transparency, but I do think that extra legalism captures this phenomena, which is that the legal system has in various ways, whether it's through not looking at post-Boumediene cases, whether it's through qualified immunity, whether it's through, you know, qualified immunity with respect to the pretextual use of immigration law, the Ashcroft roundups, that the legal system has actually approved what many outside the United States instinctively think of as illegal conduct. And so, I mean, I actually saw extralegalism as a concept that would perhaps be a bridge from American lawyers to European lawyers, because certainly, you know, having taught and been at conferences in Europe, you see a lot of kind of instinctive responses in Europe that it's all extra legal, it's all John Yoo, and it's all this kind of, you know, thuggish, not obeying the rules. And part of my concept of extra legalism is to say, well, you know, to Europeans who feel that way, you may think that this is extra legal. It may be extra legal in your system, but it is something that within the American legal system is supported or at least condoned, because all the branches know about this and they're not really taking action with respect to stopping it. So even something like Bivens' remedies, the idea that you don't have a remedy for a violation of a constitutional right unless Congress explicitly authorizes it is one that's kind of odd in many constitutional systems in Europe, and indeed in Canada, where the European Convention says you have a right to an effective remedy. You have a constitutional right to an effective remedy. And so, I mean, I realize that this concept of extralegalism is provocative, but it was really one where I was attempting to bridge a gap that I was seeing between American and European lawyers, with European lawyers saying this is all, you know, extra legal, and American lawyers, I think, rightly given their legal system, saying it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, and I think that's very helpful. I think to me one of the reasons I found it very provocative and sometimes disagreed with it is that it assumes that a lot of the underlying actions are in fact illegal. Because essentially what you're saying is that we take a position and either it's based on European law or it's based on some conception of international law or it's based on some conception of natural law. It's based on some conception of law that disagrees with the American system, and we see America violate that or act in violation of that, let's say. And then the way we explain it is by saying, well, sure, it's illegal in this broader sense or from this perspective, but within the confines of the American legal system, it's actually perfectly legal. And here we're talking about the things like habeas post-Boumediene and military commissions once they've been vetted. And I suppose what's provocative, I think, for a lot of American readers and listeners is the assumption that the Europeans have it right on the underlying legal issue. For instance, that individuals held at Guantanamo Bay do get, you know, habeas as if they were, or to the extent that they were criminal prisoners, rather than what a lot of Americans believe, that, you know, that these are prisoners of war, and so they don't necessarily get habeas. And so I just want to be crisp on that kind of conceptual point.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I think that that is a fair criticism, but I do think that, you know, indeterminate detention without trial and this sort of avoiding, or, you know, this new blend we have of the laws of war and the laws of crime do strike many people as contrary to established international law principles. But, I mean, I take your point that there is an assumption, at least, that the rest of the world, or much of the rest of the world, has trouble accepting the legality of these measures. And that could have been, I perhaps, more strongly argued in the book. But I kind of felt that a lot of that scholarship had already been done and was out there. And what I'm more interested in the study of comparative law and transnational law, is trying to bridge these different understandings of legality in the United States and the rest of the world. And in fact, I mean, you know, events subsequent to the book being completed, I think shows that even from a practical sense, Americans have to deal with these international perceptions. So, you know, the fact that President Obama can issue a waiver of the possibility of military detention and military trials with respect to when it is necessary to get counterterrorism cooperation from third countries suggests that even Americans cannot ignore the fact that many other countries will view these actions as extra legal, even if they are spelled out in an act of Congress or spelled out in an executive order. And so I think from the vantage point of comparative law, and also frankly from someone who's interested in transnational cooperation with respect to counterterrorism, the American government cannot afford to ignore perceptions, even if they don't accept those perceptions, that some American counterterrorism conduct, like military detention and military commissions, is not acceptable under traditional understandings of the law of war.
One of the themes that you talk about throughout the book is the growing dissatisfaction and what you often call cynicism with the criminal law as an adequate tool to deal with counterterrorism. And it's certainly true that we've often had very awkward blends of criminal law and military law principles. But I wonder what you think that the ideal position is. And the reason I ask is as follows. So it seems that rightly or wrongly, we, and I don't think just the United States, but many Western societies, have decided that terrorism in particular cannot be tolerated and that prevention is incredibly important. And so we have a number of consequences that flow from that. First is the use of intelligence techniques that may be incompatible, frankly, with traditional criminal procedures. Mm-hmm. And second is the increasing criminalization of actions earlier and earlier in the process. So material support, various associational crimes, conspiracy attempt, really pushing it back as far as possible so that we can prevent, because once a terrorist attack has happened, that's just, it's too late considered. And so the question there is, first, is it possible, frankly, to shape the criminal law to satisfy our demands in terms of counterterrorism? But second, and perhaps more importantly, should we want to? And the reason I ask that is one can argue that if one changes the criminal law to satisfy our counterterrorism policies, one will have sacrificed an enormous part of that criminal law. And that there is no guarantee, for instance, that the compromises to criminal procedure, to compromises to inchoate crimes that we make in the terrorism context won't spill over into other crimes and essentially just weaken the criminal law protections that are presumably one of the most attractive parts of that. And so basically it's an argument for hiving off terrorism entirely so as not to infect, so to say, the rest of the criminal law.
You know, I mean that's a very serious concern, and it's one as a criminal lawyer that I worry about. But having said that, I think recognizing those dangers, the criminal law still has an extremely important and valuable place, both because it respects, generally respects human rights in a way that commands, broad base in international respect, but also because it publicizes and denounces those who are planning to engage in terrorist violence. And so, where I really draw the line on a lot of these things, I think it's a fairly useful line to draw, is the line at secret evidence. And so it seems that once you're using evidence that is not disclosed to the person that you are attempting to punish or incapacitate, then you've gone, over a pretty firm line that the criminal law has generally observed. And, whether it's the Belmarsh detainees in the UK or those subject to control orders, whether it's detainees at Guantanamo, whether it's those people detained under administrative law, immigration law, security certificates in Canada. One of the things that I'm concerned about is that although security professionals may have some very powerful arguments about why intelligence must be used as evidence and not disclosed to the person, that this that there's a real danger that secret evidence will make those subject to it kind of fairness martyrs. You also see this in a lot of the concerns about the 1267 listing process in the UN. And so although I have no problems with using and keeping secret intelligence for traditional intelligence purposes in terms of surveillance and not allowing people to enter a country, I do have some real reservations about the use of intelligence as a form of secret evidence. And as I like to think, at least throughout the book, those reservations can be cashed out both with respect to human rights and the right to a fair trial and the right to confront your accusers, but I also think increasingly can be cashed out from a security perspective. So I think, that there is an argument that, say, in Canada, where a number of people alleged to be associated with Al-Qaeda have been subjected to basically indeterminate administrative detention on the basis of secret evidence, this has made these people in some circles almost heroes, because I think most people recognize that there's a kind of, basic unfairness of being confronted with secret evidence. And so I think that the discipline of the criminal process, frankly, needs to be put upon intelligence agencies. Here, I think to a certain extent, at least domestically, the United States is ahead of a lot of other countries where we have civilian domestic security intelligence agencies who basically don't want to live with the scrutiny that public evidence and the criminal process of confrontation is going to present to their practices.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining us. We've unfortunately run out of time, but it's a fantastic book and a very interesting conversation, and it absolutely deserves to be read.
I'd like to thank you, Alan, for having so carefully and thoughtfully read the book.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's an episode we recommend.
History This Week September 11, 2001. Captain Richard Thornton is piloting his ferry boat across New York Harbor when he sees two planes hit the World Trade Center.
And that's when we pulled a 180-degree turn and we just headed south to the World Trade Center area.
Soon, countless other ferries, tugboats, and pleasure crafts join him.
All available boats, this is the United States Coast Guard. Anyone want to help with the evacuation of Lower Manhattan, report to Governor's Island.
Find out how this heroic, impromptu rescue mission came together and how Captain Thornton sees it 20 years later on History This Week, available where.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.